Speak up. Speak up. Speak up. Speak up. Speak up. Speak up.
Speak up.
Speak up. Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good Monday morning. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, and this is Speak Up. I am Kira. I will be your host for today. And as was said in the lovely Speak Up intro, we at SFU Burnaby are located on the unceded territory of the Coast Salish people, the Tsleil-Waututh, Squamish, Musqueam, and Coquitlam people, specifically. So it's Pride Week in Vancouver. Happy Pride. And today is a special episode for Pride. And I hope everyone's Pride Week is starting well. I certainly hope that everyone has who's interested and wants to celebrate Pride has a lot to look forward to. I know that I do. I'm particularly excited about Van Vogue Jam's Kiki Vogue Ball, which is happening on Thursday. And if you want to know more about that, I'm going to have an interview on tomorrow's Speak Up, also at 10 a.m., with Ralph Escamillon, who is previously a member of the House of Amazon. He's the founder of Van Vogue Jam and is the mother of Vancouver's first Kiki House, the Kiki House of Visalia. So if you want to learn more about the ball that's happening in Vancouver and also about ballroom culture and Vogue a little more broadly, then you can tune in tomorrow at 10 a.m. Yeah, honestly, there's just so much going on in Vancouver over the next week. And there's a lot to look into if you want to go out and celebrate Pride. Definitely one of the best times of year for queer parties. moving on, so today's show is going to start off with a little bit of music from a wonderful artist called Perfume Genius, and then I'm going to launch into a quick discussion about Pride, go over a little bit of the history of Pride, because sometimes that history isn't talked about as much as it should be, and it's just important to know. And then I will have an interview with Julia Lane about resources for inclusive writing on gender identity and sexual orientation. So without further ado, this is Queen by Perfume Genius. Beautiful song, beautiful artist. They've collaborated with people like Christine and the Queens. And yeah, I love this song so much, and I hope you guys love it too.
Don't you know you're queen?
Don't you know me?
And we're back. This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM. I'm Kira. I hope everyone's having a good Monday morning. It's late enough now that I feel like most people are starting to be a little bit more awake. I know that having already been awake for 5 hours myself, I'm feeling... Actually, you know what? I'm feeling tired. I was going to say I'm feeling more awake, but I'm just feeling tired. As is what happens when you get up too early and get too little sleep. Anywho, so... As I mentioned in the introduction to the show, it's Pride Week in Vancouver. And I'm sure many people know that although here in Vancouver, Pride is in the first week of August, Pride Month, more around the world and in different places, is actually officially in June. So in places that it is safe to celebrate Pride, that is when the festivities and protests would be happening. Except for Vancouver, apparently, which likes to do it in August, which, I mean, you can't complain necessarily. You know, you can get multiple prides kind of slotted into your summer if you plan it right. Yeah, so in 2019 and in places that offer a larger degree of safety to queer people than in other places, so like Canada is relatively quite safe for people in the LGBT community. Like being here, it can be easy to forget where and who Pride came from. And the realities of Pride today in places that aren't Canada. So it's really important to remember where and what Pride started as, and the people who led the to remember that the people who led the fight for queer liberation were and often still are queer people of color, and that even despite this fact, it is still queer people of color who are suffering the violence of homophobia and transphobia most intensely today. So we cannot forget where Pride came from, and we need to remember who. To whom we owe the freedoms that we have achieved. So with that in mind, I want to start by getting some of the essential bits of Pride's history kind of out there so people can have maybe a better base knowledge than they might already. And I also want to say that this is very surface level. I'm doing my best to cover the basics in the short period of time that I have, but I will inevitably forget to mention some people, some places, some events. So I really think that if it's something you want to do, you should look into this yourself. And if I forget something and you want to let me know, please do. You can contact me at the station, and I'll take on your feedback and do my best to do better next time. So, the origins of Pride. Pride as we know it today, like I said, takes place in June, largely as a commemoration of the 1969 Stonewall Rebellion, which took place at the Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village in New York City. So at that period in time in the United States, and this is not to say that this isn't true today for some people in some places, because it absolutely is, but at that period in time in the U.S., LGBTQ people were heavily, heavily discriminated against. Homosexual acts and queerness more widely, in all of its forms, was illegal. And people were frequently the target of police violence and surveillance. So the Stonewall Rebellion, also known as the Stonewall Riots, but I don't like to use the term riot because this terminology is often mobilized against people, and particularly people of color, to delegitimize their actions and to attempt to kind of enable the like violent police repression that often happens. The Stonewall Rebellion took place in response to a police raid on the Stonewall Inn. These raids were quite regular at the time. And it was a frequent occurrence. People who would attend the Stonewall Inn were subjected to violence and humiliation on the part of the police. And this particular raid was no different. So people were being targeted by the police, but this time those who were being targeted fought back. During these raids, it was general practice for the police to humiliate, assault, and arrest anyone that was wearing clothing that was not considered to, and I'm doing air quotes here, match their gender. And they would also do the same thing to anyone who was dancing with someone of the same sex. This raid was no different. This was all happening again. And patrons of the bar were being violently handled by police. They were being humiliated, assaulted, and detained. And during this particular raid, when a black butch lesbian called Stormé de Lavery was clubbed in the head by a police officer for complaining that her handcuffs were too tight and that she was being injured, people had enough. They fought back. And this is what kind of sparked the Stonewall Rebellion. Some important names to remember. So obviously, like I said, Stormé de Lavery, is an important name, but also a black queen and self-identified drag queen, Marsha P. Johnson, and a Latinx queen, Sylvia Rivera, were among the first people at the Stonewall Inn to take action on that day, throwing, like, quote, the first bricks, as it were. Also, a thing to note in this context, the term queen does not necessarily mean the same thing as drag queen. Those are two different terms. And in my understanding, queen at that time was a term commonly used as a self-descriptor for trans women. Yeah, so just something to keep in mind. So yes, important names to remember: Stormy DeLavery, Marsha P. Johnson, and Sylvia Rivera. These are just a few of the people that helped start the movement towards queer liberation in North America. And you just can't forget these names and the people that actually started the protest that is Pride today. And the origins of Pride are a protest. That's easy to forget, because in Vancouver in particular, and like a lot of places in North America, it has become a party and a celebration, which it should be in some ways, but it also has a history as a protest, and it still needs to maintain its elements of protest, because being a part of the LGBT community and being queer is still something that's very unsafe in a lot of places, and we need to, even in places where it is safe, we need to protest in solidarity with the people where it isn't safe. I was doing some reading this morning, got kind of emotional, possibly because I'm so tired, but also because it's something to get emotional about. I was reading about a town in Poland had its first Pride parade very recently, and it's a very conservative town. It's in the Bible Belt of Poland. It's the kind of central hub of their far-right party that's like deeply associated with like the far-right and like the alt-right. But what happened in this town is it was its first Pride parade, and the Pride protesters, like the LGBT people, were met with extreme violence and harsh backlash. People were being attacked in the streets. Rainbow flags were being burned. Gangs of thugs were attacking people. In one instance, a large man in a red balaclava was kicking everyone that he could get his hands on, essentially, including teenage girls. And people were running away, but they would be chased by people trying to hurt them just because they're queer. So that's a reality in a lot of the world, and we can't just let Pride be a celebration when that's still happening. Yeah. If you want to kind of, there's a lot of good reading out there to learn more about the reality of Pride currently and the history of Pride. So definitely lots of resources to go into. And again, I've done my best to represent the origins of Pride as the best I can, but of course I probably have missed things. So definitely, if you want to, do some reading yourself and learn more. So another article that I liked that helped me kind of look at Pride as a celebration a little more critically, and to kind of understand the queer community's at times complicated relationship with Pride celebrations, was an article by Philip Henry on them.us called "Perfectly Steeped: Pride is Still an Elitist White Gay Fantasy." It's an article that kind of talks about the history of Pride a bit, and then addresses the corporatization of Pride and Pride celebrations and parades, and then the fact that Pride is an event that, and the festivities around Pride often center cis white gay men, who are arguably the members of the community who have the most access to the most privileges. And these celebrations often still ignore the issues of like queer and trans people and people of color. So yeah, just an interesting article that I learned a lot from. Okay, so that was a good conversation. I hope I was able to help some people learn a little bit, or just like have an interesting kind of dialogue there. Next up, I have another great song. This one is by some local artists, Des Hume, and I'm gonna say their name wrong, I think, Biowana. If I can find it, because my computer isn't working right now. Okay, I haven't been able to find the song that I want to play, but I will be playing Out of the Woods by Des Hume. Also, yeah, and a local artist, very, very talented, and having met them, the singer, once, just a nice person. Definitely a very nice person. Okay, here's Out of the Woods by Des Hume.
Bird Note. It's a warm, sunny day, and we're watching an American robin sitting on the ground, its wings outstretched and its tail splayed out behind it. If you look more closely, you might see something a bit shocking. The robin is sitting on top of an anthill, and ants are swarming all over its body. You might even see the robin take an ant in its bill and wipe it underneath its wings. So, what's happening? Well, it's kind of like an avian spa treatment. Ornithologists call it anting. Although you might not see it too often, more than 250 species of birds have been recorded doing it. The purpose of anting remains something of a mystery, although most experts agree it has to do with transferring the ant's secretions to the bird's body. It's likely that the ant's formic acid helps the bird control feather mites and other parasites. Some birds have been seen using citrus fruits, mothballs, and even glowing embers to achieve the same effects. One clever bird, a rook, the British cousin of the American crow, even learned to strike a match, then touch the hot tip under its wing. Talk about a hot spa treatment. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
A lovely bird fact from Bird Note. I'm Kira. This is CJSF 90.1 FM. You're listening to Speak Up. Again, it wouldn't be a CJSF program run by me if I didn't have a technical difficulty where I couldn't play the song I wanted to play. But that was Out of the Woods by Des Hume, local artist. Definitely great, great music. Worth checking out. So, I am just about to do I'm joined in studio by Julia Lane, and we're going to do a lovely little interview about some of the work that Julia is doing. So, a bit of an intro to Julia based on her bio from the SFU Library. Julia is a queer, vegan, feminist, and a white settler who lives at mothers' rights and teaches on unceded Coast Salish territories. She has a PhD in arts education and currently works as a writing services associate with the Student Learning Commons. I've met Julia a few times through some of the writing assistance that she was doing at Out on Campus, and hopefully I'll get a chance to know her a little bit better over the next 30 minutes or so. Hi, Julia.
Hello.
How are you doing this morning?
I'm alive, alert, awake, and enthusiastic.
It's good to hear. just also, we have been joined by the construction noise that is a persistent reality at CJSF.
Hooray.
So, yeah, that's fun. So if you hear a weird humming, whirring sound in the background, it's the construction.
It's not us.
It's not us. We're not just here, like, hammering on the table or anything. Okay, so launching into the interview, I wanted to start off by talking just a little bit about you and your education. You hold a PhD in arts education, and what was the path that led you to this degree, and what was your dissertation on?
So the path, there's lots of different ways to answer this question, and I'm going to try to give you the shortest one. The educational path that I took is I did my undergraduate degree at York University in theater. In theater creation and performance, and I, when I finished that degree, I was sort of facing the world of possibly auditioning for shows and trying to live a life on stage, which still appeals to me in a lot of ways, but is also terrifying. So I decided to do a master's, and when I was in my final year of my undergraduate degree, I was taking a lot of my theater courses, but I was also taking Indigenous studies courses, courses in feminist theory, and a lot of courses in environmental education. And I was seeing connections between these things and realizing that I was seeing the connections, but I wasn't seeing things written about that. So I decided to do a master's degree, which I did at Trent University in a program called Canadian Studies and Indigenous Studies. And wrote a master's thesis about the interconnections between theater, environmental education, and Indigenous knowledges. And then when I finished that, simultaneous through all of that, actually, was doing clown training at at a place called the Clown Farm, or it's now called the Manitoulin Conservatory for Creation and Performance. And so I was doing a lot of that training and realized that I actually wanted to be doing a study about clowning, even though there was part of me that thought, I need to get out of academic work. I need to go live in a tree for a while. but then decided that I was already starting to research for a PhD. So applied to do the PhD here in arts education about clown. And that's what my dissertation was about, is about clowning as a theatrical practice. But how do we take the fundamental principles of that clowning practice and apply them to the work of academics? So apply them to reading, writing, research,
That's fascinating. I have such a limited knowledge of clowning. I mean, my experience with it is like birthday clowns, you know, which is such a small fraction of what clowning even is as an artistic practice. Yeah, that's fascinating. I would never
you didn't even know what that question was going to open up.
Yeah, that's really cool. So you now work at the Student Learning Commons, so I'm sure some of the students, staff, and faculty who are hopefully listening have met you before. So my understanding is that at the Student Learning Commons you provide writing support and workshops to primarily undergraduate students.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of things that you help people with?
Sure, yeah. So I, as a writing services associate, I don't work as much one-on-one with students anymore as I used to. I started working at the Student Learning Commons when I was a graduate student here doing my PhD, and I absolutely loved it. And in that context, I did a lot of more direct one-on-one writing support. So I would meet with students, talk to them about their writing. Sometimes staff our online tutoring platform, which is called WriteAway. So students can submit a paper and get feedback sent back to them electronically. So I did a lot of different things. Now I primarily help to set up and ensure that there is staffing for our what we call course integrated writing workshops. So that's when an instructor says, there's a writing assignment in my class and I've taught the content, but there's writing expectations that the students are not necessarily feeling supported to meet those expectations. Could you come in and do a workshop specifically about, and it's often like how to write an effective argument or paragraphing, structuring, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So we'll come in, we'll design a workshop specifically for that class and come into the class. And I teach a lot of those, but I also make sure that they're the ones that I'm not teaching myself. I make sure somebody is available to teach them.
Yeah.
And I work on developing things like resources. And one of the things that's been really, two of the things that have been really exciting since I've been in the job is we've launched a blog. So I've been updating this blog bi-weekly for almost a year now. So we have that as sort of like a, it's resources, but it's more like, I try to think about it as more like real talk resources and not just stuffy resources, which we don't want to have stuffy resources.
Yeah.
And then I've also been doing, where I do get to do the one-on-one student support is I, on Mondays, I am at Out on Campus, and on Thursdays, I'm in the Indigenous Student Center. So I go there for 2 hours a week, and I'm available if students want to talk about their writing on a drop-in basis, and that's been fabulous. It's like they're the highlights of my week. I love those times.
It's a great resource, too. I've gotten your help with a couple of things. Very, very, it's a great resource. Love it. The reason that we're actually talking today is because you're working on a fantastic project that you told me about. It's focusing on inclusive writing. Would you like to tell people listening briefly what inclusive writing means in like a broader sense, and maybe why it's important?
Sure. So it's a bit of a hard thing to define inclusive writing. For the purposes of my working on this writing guide or these writing resources, I've been thinking about inclusive writing being about having an intention when you're writing to, on purpose, make sure that your writing is including as many perspectives, peoples, and groups as possible, and also to recognize that there are ways of using language that are exclusionary and can even be harmful. And sometimes those, even though they can create harm, the impact can be harm, the intention is not to create harm. The intention is just, this is the habits of the way that I've always used language and I've never thought about them before. So there's like a disconnect between the intention and the impact sometimes. And so the purpose of bringing attention to inclusive writing is to think about how can we write with the intention to think and get really curious about what does this language mean? Where does it come from? So it kind of connects a bit with you talking about the history of Pride. Mm-hmm. You know, we can easily just think, oh, Pride's a parade. But if we take a step back and get curious about Pride, we can learn about the history and know more about how to think and talk about that. And that's the same with language. If we take a step back from language, we can recognize that words and language use is not neutral. It has all kinds of cultural significance that we may or may not know about or even think about. And so the big picture for me about inclusive writing is about curiosity, and about thinking about intentionally choosing language that has an impact that invites people into our writing rather than unintentionally excluding people from it.
Okay, yeah, really important. So I've got a few kind of more, I guess, complex questions about inclusive writing and language that we use in talking about gender identity and sexuality. Here we go. Okay, so I've found in terms of my own education in, like, post-secondary, it's, like, something I've been taught about, is that in the past there's been, and even currently, there has been a focus in the language that we use on this idea of a white, able-bodied, cis male subject, and, like, a lot of the writing in academia is heavily gendered and structured around this kind of idea of this supposedly universal subject. Why do you think that has existed in the past?
That is a huge question.
Yeah, it is. I know, I'm sorry.
But thank you. No, thank you for inviting me to talk about it. I don't know if I'll be able to give, like, the most satisfactory answer, because I think there's a lot of different ways of coming at that question.
Definitely.
But probably the easiest way into that question is that that is a byproduct of privilege. So when we think about privilege, sometimes we use that word and we, again, don't take a step back from it and look at what does that really mean to be privileged. This has actually been an interest of mine, is that often I find people are really, I am a white person, and often white people are very reactive to that word of privilege because they think it means your life has never been hard. That's not what privilege means. It doesn't mean that you've never experienced challenge. It doesn't mean that everything's always been easy for you. And I think because of the connotation of that word privilege, it can sound like somebody is discounting the fact that you have struggled in your life. But what privilege really means is that we live in a society and a culture that has been set up, has been structured with you in mind, because it's been set up and structured by people who are like you. And so when you go about your day-to-day business, you don't run up against as many hurdles or as many challenges, because the people who set up those day-to-day structures and institutions were like you. So they set them up to meet your needs. And academia is one such institution. Mm-hmm. Academic institutions are absolutely institutions that started as places for the elite, places for people who had the wealth and the opportunity to dedicate themselves to a life of the intellect.
Yeah.
And so they were very much, explicitly in the beginning of academic institutions, they were set up to be places for men and white men. So it was not places where that sort of those things were, those questions of what does it mean to be not a man? What does it mean to be not white? What does it mean to experience these other things in the world? Those were not questions that were on the minds of the people who are doing this academic work, who are setting up these academic institutions. Now, of course, we've come a long way from that time, and a lot of thought has been going into now how do we take these institutions and make them more inclusive, but their starting places were very exclusive and intentionally very exclusive. I find this really interesting from the perspective of a writer, because a lot of the time I'm encouraging students to write in a way that is easy to read. But so much of what we read in academic context is not easy to understand.
Not at all.
Not at all, right? And so it's like, but no, if I want it to be academic, I'm doing air quotes as well, if I want it to be an academic piece of writing, it should be really hard to understand. And that's what I'll aim for. And we're laughing about it, but it's true. It feels like for it to be in that academic genre, it needs to be dense prose. I need to use words that I'm not sure I understand, because when I'm reading these articles that I'm reading, these book chapters, there are words that I'm not sure I understand. And so that's kind of what we aim for. And there absolutely was, I wish I remember the name of the philosopher, but I don't. But a philosopher was talking about, and this is like an old white dead guy, one of those, was talking about his work and saying, like, it is intentionally challenging because I want only the people who are up to the challenge to understand my work. It's not for everyone. And so it is that elitist, privileged idea that we are creating a sphere in the world that is for these privileged people who want to really stretch and exercise their minds, but that's not for everyone. And that's obviously highly problematic.
Absolutely. Oh my goodness.
And that was a way of thinking. And we now, my sense, and this is what one of the things that I felt very called to as a student and still feel really called to, is that, like, it's our challenge now to push that, to not just accept the academy as it was created at the beginning and be like, okay, well, that's what academic means, so I guess I better, like, perpetuate that, and if I want to be an academic, I have to meet that standard. Like, no, we have to go, what do we want academia to look like and be? Because it doesn't have to just be one thing. And we are here now. We are here. We are, you know, I'm a queer woman and I am here and I can push those boundaries and say no, like, it has been that in the past and now it needs to change.
Absolutely.
And now it needs to be able to reflect who we are and where we are. But there's a lot of pushing that needs to happen, and there are a lot of people who have been doing it for a long time, which is fantastic. So we have those people to look up to and to stand on their shoulders, which is wonderful. But that's so my not so short answer about why it's been like that in the past and largely still currently is because it really rests on this very strong foundation of being set up to intentionally be that.
Mm-hmm.
And why this work is so important to me is because I feel like if we don't, it's when something is set up and structured to be a particular way, it's very easy for it to always fall back into that pattern and that habit, because that's the groove that it created for itself. If you want to move it out of that groove and out of those habits, you got to, like, it's constant work to keep it out of there, because otherwise it will fall back into that. And so we have an opportunity to say, well, I'm going to do this differently, but that's not easy. And there are power dynamics that are still at play in that.
Yeah.
So.
Definitely. I mean, that kind of leads into the next point that I wanted to talk about. So, this one's kind of already been covered, like, why it's important to move away from this supposedly universal subject. Because, like, there isn't a universal subject. And that's something that needs to, like you're saying, needs to be challenged and, like, pushed against. There is no one universal way of, like, existing and interacting with information and receiving information. And
Yeah. Absolutely. And that's, I mean, to me, that is what has been the I'm going to use privilege in a different way now, what has been the privilege for me of being in the world of academia has been the opportunity to hear about all the different ways that people come at something that we otherwise could assume was universal. So I've been, I did my degree in theater, as I mentioned, and one of the things that is often talked about as being, like, a universal principle of theater is that there has to be conflict. But I've been reading a book by Daniel David Moses right now, who's a queer indigenous man, and he was talking about how he did a theater degree too and was taught that there always has to be conflict, and that never sat well with him because that's not the way that he understands the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we kind of, I feel like we settle for an idea of this universality. We're like, okay, well, I don't really know how to deal. I don't really know how to understand something that is outside of my own experience. And so I'll just assume that there is a universal experience that everybody can kind of relate to, because it's easier, in a way, to think that.
Right.
And to think that, well, everybody's experience must be at least some gradation of similarity to my own. But when we can really open that up and go, well, what if your experience is completely different from my own? And that's been really, like, doing my degree in Indigenous studies was absolutely a privilege for me and hugely challenging, but wonderful to be able to have the opportunity to take all these things that had been just taken for granted in my whole life, because they were just my life, right? And I'm going through my life, I'm not assuming that I'm so different from everybody else in the world, but then to have these things that I think were, that I thought were just, quote, normal or the way things were, and be like, oh, there's another way to look at this. There are layers to this experience. There is difference. There is difference in this and gradations. And that is actually very helpful and can lead to really startling, like, wow, the world is also this.
Yeah.
And actually, that's something that I take from clown training. So to bring that back in, we often think that in everyday conversations that there's like either or, like either this is right or it's wrong. And clown logic, what we talk about in clown training, is both and. So it can be both right and wrong. Something can be, you know, have both of those, hold both of those experiences in it. And that is not comfortable to have to hold those two things together and be like, but I want it to just be one or the other. But it can, just because it's not comfortable doesn't mean it's not true.
Yeah.
So why do I think it's important for us to move away from that universal subject is because it's exclusionary.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it discounts people's real experiences and makes it impossible for them, or certainly very, very challenging, more challenging than it needs to be, to actually be here. Because if we say, no, this is the way that it is, and you're saying, but it's not the way that it is for me, every day you're fighting a different kind of battle just to show up.
Yeah.
Which is not what we want. I don't think. It's certainly not what I want the experience of people to be when they arrive here. I want them to arrive here and for us to go, like, I'm really curious about what it's like for you. Not, here's what it's like, and if you can't get on board with that, then get out.
Yeah. So, on that note, how does inclusive writing and strategies around inclusive writing actually strengthen academic research?
So, I think that it strengthens it because it means that you're not starting from a place of assumption. And it, like I said, I feel like the challenge of inclusive writing is really a challenge of curiosity. That we don't start from, I already know about this, which is often, you do have to, when you're doing research, you start from something that you know something about. But when we can always be kind of taking a step back and going, so when I framed this question, what were the assumptions that were embedded in the question? Because I use these words in this order. And that's, you can get really meta about all of that and think about your language until the end of time. And at some point, we also have to be able to pick some words and put them down on a page.
Yeah.
But when we do that, picking the words and putting them down on the page with much more care and thought than maybe we're used to, where we go, okay, well, I don't want that. What does that word really mean, and where does it come from, and how has it been used, and how might it be harmful, or how might it actually uphold and invite people in and support them? Like, language does that. Language has an impact. It's not just neutral, and it is our currency in academia. It's our product. We're not building benches. We're writing. We're using language. And so that is what we have to offer. And when we can make that offering with more care and more respect, with the intention to invite more people in, rather than with the intention to keep it an elite sphere, then we can, I think, do much better work.
Mm-hmm.
We can start from a place that is more curious and open to being challenged, and we can also have our work be more meaningful to more people. We know that one of the common complaints of academia is we're in the ivory tower here at SFU. We're actually up on a mountain looking down at everybody else, and people feel like this is not, it has nothing to do with me, it's not about my life, and it's not helping. So why would we be devoting ourselves and our lives to this? So to me, the challenge of it is actually an invitation to think about who can we offer this work to?
Yeah.
And could that offering be bigger than it has been? Bigger than we even thought it could be?
Mm-hmm. So to bring it to a little bit more of a focused topic, a focus point on this topic, the resource guide that you are constructing around inclusive writing has a section, it has a few sections, but it also has a section that's specifically on writing about gender identity and sexual orientation. Why did you find it necessary to make this particular guide, and why did you choose to make these individual sections that you chose?
I struggle still a little bit with having the individual sections, and one of the byproducts of me struggling with that is that I also have a piece in the glossary about intersectionality. It's the first entry in the glossary, because these experiences are not isolated from each other. But for the sake of, again, being able to put words down on a page, which is something that as a writer I have often struggled with, is like, writing on a page is so linear, and it's even that, even the way that we have done these things, it's not just the words, but it's also the structure and the form have particular meanings. But I'm not answering your question right now, so I will try to focus myself. So the reason I thought that it was important, one of the reasons that led me in very basically to including a section on gender identity and sexual orientation was the number of times I get asked questions about pronoun use.
Okay.
And in writing, and whether or not it is okay to use a singular gender neutral they in writing. Some people are very strongly of the camp that they must always be plural, and they're wrong. If you're strongly of that camp, if you feel like I've just your opinion, you can come debate with me at the Student Learning Commons. I'd be very happy to have that debate with you. But there's a long history of the pronoun they being used in a singular form as a gender-neutral term in the English language. Well, they're knocking the university down behind us. Not really. But so I get asked questions about that, and even when I don't get asked questions about it, I feel like there is like an undercurrent of anxiety about writing in a way that is inclusive,
mm-hmm.
About using language and terminology appropriately and respectfully. I think many, many, many people, that's what they want to do. They don't want their writing to be exclusionary or harmful, but they don't necessarily feel like they know how, or
yeah.
that they have a place that they can turn. Now, of course, there are many places you can turn because of the internet, but you know, internet has varying degrees of accuracy and helpfulness. So I wanted to have something that we had put together where it was all in one place and you could go to it. And there are also additional resources that you can look into for more information. And also, one of the things that I find really interesting, and I think you have a question about it later on in the interview, but is how much language changes.
Yeah.
And language about the way people describe their experiences and their identity changes, and it needs to change.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we experience a really strong resistance to that change, partially because people feel... I think it comes from two directions. If you are a person who was connected to that language that's changing, you're like, but this is... I feel like this is how I've described my identity, so please don't take that away from me.
Yeah.
So there's like an ownership piece of, oh, you're now changing this, and I feel strongly connected to this term. So there's like that can be hard from an insider perspective. And I think from an outsider perspective, sometimes it can feel like, I just figured out how to use language properly and inclusively, and now you're changing it on me again. So it's just like, and that's why actually one of the principles that I... very first principles in the overview that I wrote is that inclusive writing is not at its core about learning like a list of sanctioned or an unsanctioned words. It's not a vocabulary test,
yeah.
Which is sometimes how people come at it. It's like, if I can just learn the right words and have the list, like here's the ones you're allowed to use and here's the ones you're not, then I'll nail it. And that's not how it actually works. Inclusive writing really is about actually caring about people,
yeah.
and caring to be respectful. And caring to be respectful means recognizing that if you're talking to an individual person or about an individual person, you need to care enough about them to learn what are their language preferences.
Yeah.
Because they're not necessarily going to be the same as somebody else's, and it's not okay to just decide for them.
Mm-hmm.
So. Pronoun use was a lot of questions and conversations about that, and also just people feeling like, I can't keep up with all of these changing terminologies. But the changing terminologies are a reflection of the fact that we are getting better slowly at inviting more voices into the conversation.
Absolutely. It's interesting that pronoun usage was one of the things that was coming up a lot for you when you were helping people. I remember writing a paper, I think it was for like a first year GSWS course, and I was referencing some work by Leslie Feinberg, and Leslie used gender-neutral pronouns like here, like H-I-R,
mm-hmm.
and I got marks deducted for misspelling the
right.
word, like what was assumed to have been like a misspelling
right.
of like she/her pronouns. And I was
right.
like, actually, this is like it's not a misspelling. This was intentional.
Yes.
That's the pronouns that Leslie uses.
Right,
and it was just an interesting moment to have to
yeah.
be like, but that's not actually a mistake.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And this is another thing that I have in these resources is about write in the meta narrative. Because if you're doing something intentional to push on some of those accepted conventions of language, the person who's reading it isn't always going to know that you're doing that intentionally. Mm-hmm. And it can be looked at as a mistake. Even, hopefully, this is starting to be more commonly known, but even using a singular they pronoun as a gender-neutral pronoun, people sometimes are like, oh, it's a grammar error, which technically it's not a grammar error. I need to learn more about grammar. But but some people feel like it is a grammar error, and so they'll react to it in that way. So if you... I am a huge fan of footnotes. I know, again, this is also a controversy. Some people hate footnotes. But sometimes you make something a footnote and then it really needs to be in main text, but
yeah,
whatever.
Some controversies in academic writing.
I'm a huge geek about these things. But if you're doing something intentional that you're not sure the reader is going to understand, you put a footnote and say, this is the pronoun that this person uses and it is this way, and you can give that information in that context, and that's called writing in the meta narrative, and it can alleviate some of those like moments of, well, you just didn't really understand. So
yeah, so we talked a little bit about the evolution of language and terminology and how this was considered in the creation of the guide. What were some of the challenges you had in constructing this writing guide?
Well, it's not finished. And it's a funny story. I was originally going to try to write most of our handouts at the Student Learning Commons are like one page double-sided, maybe two pages double-sided. So that was what I was aiming for. This is now like a 28-page small book. So that was a challenge, is just realizing sort of the scope of the project. And initially I was just like, here are some bare bones, like things to think about, principles and our ideas. And I actually, my colleague Amanda and I had, so our writing and learning peers who do most of the one-on-one student consultations, who are fantastic, they meet once a week, and those meetings have a theme. So we did one on inclusive writing, and I presented some early work, and Amanda put together some stuff for them, and they were very grateful. Like, they expressed way more gratitude for it than I had anticipated. I thought, oh, this is just me and my passion project, and da-da-da, here you go. And they were like, we need this. Because they have a lot of students come to them either with questions or with writing that the peer finds harmful or exclusionary, and the peer is reacting to it in a one-on-one moment and having to do a lot of education around something that is like bigger than just writing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And can cause some real challenge to some, you know, unquestioned assumptions or beliefs about the world. And so that's hard work. That's big work. And they were like, and we don't really know. We don't have a thing. We can be like, look, just take this and then come back. So part of why it became much bigger was in response to that. Like, I was saying, well, you know, I'll work on it and I'll just get something small done for you quickly. They were like, no, just get a big thing. Get all of it. Do all of it. So thank you, peers, for pushing me to do the work. And I'm sorry if this is more than you were expecting. So that was a challenge, was just realizing the scope. And even as it is, like, there's way more. And so, like, reining it in has been hard. Yeah. As you may have been able to tell from this interview, I'm not very good at reining myself in most of the time. So that's been a challenge. And then also just, so the phase that I'm in now, the reason I say it's not done is it's been really important to me to do good consultation around it as well, because it's not a very inclusive guide if I go, here's Julia's thoughts on this, and then I never ask anybody else about it, right? Like, it's really important that the people who are likely to be most impacted by this and whose experiences I am talking about, some of which I share and some of which I don't, have a voice in this. Mm-hmm. And that's really important to me. So I've had some fabulous feedback from the president of SFU Autistics United. Viv has done a ton of work to help me on this, so gratitude in that direction, and also from Ashley and Noah at Out on Campus. So I've done some consultation already, and I'm so grateful for the support and challenge and questions I've received from those folks. I'm also, and so now I've got it out, a copy of it out to the Indigenous Student Center and a few other places that I'm going to try to get some really good. Soka, I'm coming to talk to you next, in case you're listening. So that's, yeah, my next stage is to do some good consultation. And then even once it's released, it's always open for consultation. So, because right. I realize that, you know, even going to those organizations and those individuals, that's not, they don't speak for everybody. That's not representative of everybody. So anybody who came across it, if you looked at it and said, no, that's not what it needs to be, or this needs to be changed, then I'm always going to be open to that feedback. Mm-hmm. So that constant evolution piece is like good and important. And part, I think it's actually kind of the highest principle of inclusive writing, is that you have to be open to changing things. Yeah. But it's also challenging, right? Because it means that it's hard to say, like, now this is ready for someone else to see it.
Yeah. I think the term that you kind of mentioned to me before is it's like a living resource.
Yes.
It's alive. It has the ability to change, and it will change, which is really, really cool, really fantastic. We're coming to the end of the hour. We have a few minutes left, so I'm going to skim over my questions and maybe see which one to end with. I guess, like, do you have any hopes for how, like, what the future use of this living resource will be?
I hope people will read it. I hope people I hope people who are really curious will actually sit down and read it, and engage with it as in the fullness of it, because I think that would be really exciting. And certainly those who have looked at it have looked beyond kind of some of the things that they already were familiar with, felt that they learned something. So I think that's fantastic. I hope that some instructors and faculty members will find it helpful for them too in creating assignments and creating expectations for assignments and grading assignments, so that some of what you experienced of like, okay, that was not a misspelling, like, so that it can have a wider connection with what we do in writing in an academic context. That would be my like big dream for it.
Yeah.
And I know that a lot of other writing centers at academic institutions are working on similar things, so I also hope that it can be something that gets shared around, so that some of this work is, so that it can spread, so that as a living thing it can kind of create its own ecosystem and engage with other living things.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. Thank you so much for chatting with me about this. I've learned a lot, and I'm really excited to get my hands on the writing guide once it's released to the public for as a resource. Thank you again so much.
Thank you so much. This was great.
This is the end of the hour. I believe next up we have Democracy Now, and I'm going to play us out with a fun song called To Be Real by Cheryl Lynn. Definitely like I'd say it's a bit of a queer anthem. It's pretty great. Hope you had a wonderful Monday morning, and I'll talk to you again tomorrow.
This is Radio.